Hello and welcome to the Disruptors Podcast. On the show today, we have the infamous, controversial, cancelled scientist, Robert Malone. Disclaimer, we don't support or condone anything said by Robert Malone in this podcast or anything he might have said in previous podcasts on other shows. We just want to have an open and honest discussion and debate with someone deemed to be one of the most controversial, disruptive people in his industry. Please bear that in mind, do your own research. So Rob and Robert have some pretty out there conversations, starting from who controls the world, and the conversation just goes down that rabbit hole. So let's just get straight into this. But remember, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything.
Robert, who controls the world?
I've been trying to figure that out myself lately. I don't know why, but there's a lot of interesting publications and information and speculation coming about that. I think that we're in increasingly a multipolar world, and a case has been made by many that it's a collection of about 250 different companies that are functionally in control. And on top of them are some major investment funds. Of course, we are familiar with BlackRock's State Street, Vanguard, and Bank of America. But are they really in control, or is it the Bank of International Settlements? I think that this is an important question. And of course, now we're in this kind of multipolar fragmentation environment where we have the financial consortium that seems to have been catalyzed by the Russian government in some ways in response to the sanctions, and that is increasingly allied with India, China, and perhaps Turkey and a number of other nations in creating a kind of a parallel currency structure. And then there's the argument to be made that, well, oil is king, and oil bucks are king. I think that right now, personally, my sense is that we're in a period of transition where Pax Americana is passing, and we certainly have the rise of the CCP and their various interests, and we have this transnational organization that I think is basically a trade organization of the 1,000 largest companies that we call the World Economic Forum, that is seems to style itself as a world government, and is functionally creating its own treaties with entities like the United Nations and the World Health Organization.
And do you think that that structure is for the good of humanity?
I think that the demonstration of the last 3 years shows many of us that not only is that organization not qualified, but it is grounded, that structure, and I assume now you've transitioned to speaking of the World Economic Forum. I shouldn't make assumptions. You mean the structure of this kind of fragmented multipolar environment, or what? Please clarify.
Yeah, how you presented the way that the world is controlled, that structure, however it's been created, is that for the benefit of humankind and the people?
No, I think that it's for the benefit of relatively small number of individuals who seek power, control, capital, hegemony. It's almost as if we passed into a time when instead of, with the possible exception of even the CCP, the CCP isn't China. We have a collection of hyper-powerful kind of transnational interests that seem to be seeking to dominate and control for their own interests. And it seems like humanity in general is given short shrift. And And we have these discussions and thought leaders such as Harari that advocate this logic of another industrial revolution in which one sees the fusion of man and machine. And this isn't crazy talk. This is maybe it is crazy talk, but it's not a conspiracy theory. This is documented. Sapiens is one book. And these people seem to envision something that looks an awful lot like a dark dystopia out of the Wachowskis' imagination or something. It's some cross of Terminator and the Matrix, in which we have. And I think the other one I need to do a shout out with is Bruce Sterling and the cyberpunk genre that have envisioned this world of mechs and shapers, which is kind of the universe that seems to be foreseen by the German, British, and American military industrial complex, in which we have implantables routinely employed and a combination of biomechanical modifications of humans and directed evolution or genetic modification as one vision for the future of humanity. It is profoundly egotistic. The hubris is almost overwhelming, but that does seem to be the logic. And it's a strange, having delved into this, the documentation from the German military, the UK military, the US military, particularly DARPA in this area of transhumanism, it seems that the logic is put forward that our opponents are already doing it. And the inference is that this is the Chinese Communist Party and People's Republic of China have no ethical boundaries in performing this type of developmental work with human subjects. And therefore, we must do it. It's kind of the same logic as mutually assured destruction and thermonuclear weapons. They're doing it, therefore we have to do it. Of course, then that provokes their belief that they have to do it. And we get into a circular escalation of this kind of technology in which breaching well-established biomedical ethical boundaries is just considered kind of a casualty of real politic and war. Have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to come to the convergence of man and machine and AI in a moment, but what would be a better, more utopic, not dystopic world order?
I think we have a number of major axes going on here that in order to answer your question, we need to kind of set the stage or at least give some framework to be able to start to shape our imagined world, our intellectual world, our own ability to process what's coming at us or being forced on us. In my mind, We're increasingly the logic of a lower upper middle class structure is obsolete, and that we're increasingly in a world of physicals, virtuals, and overlords. And this is a logic and a language that's just starting to enter the mainstream right now, physicals being people that work with their hands and actually do stuff, and truckers and physicians, and virtuals being those, the laptop class is the slang, those that live in a world typically urban in which, and by the way, journalists are considered part of that, and in which it's all virtual information and there's no real connection with the actual world. As a matter of fact, a lot of these people seek to become increasingly isolated from what they perceive as a threatening real world. And then on top of that, we have this very, very small cast of uber wealthy that seem to be controlling everything and increasingly trying to make the physicals obsolete through mechanization and this new industrial revolution in which it's believed there will be massive surplus labor, excess labor, you know, these various words like useless eaters, that is not really needed because of the automation and the effects of machine learning and deep learning. And I think what the laptop virtual class doesn't recognize is that those folks at the top, which I refer to as the overlords, they're just as soon glad to get rid of the virtuals also. Some other virtuals seem to think they're protected, but they're going to be easily disposed of when the time comes. They're just kind of a useful tool in the interim. So I think we have to think about what is the nature of the world going forward now. And another key axis in this is the belief system that really goes back to the 40s or before. UN Charter is very much grounded in it. The World Health Organization Charter is grounded in it, which is the belief that it's necessary in order to solve the world's problems that we migrate to a global government, and that the idea of the independent nation state is obsolete and it's a barrier to solving the world's problems. That's kind of that package. And of course, that's a core thesis in the what has been pitched as global warming, but increasingly the fallback position is climate change, because the data aren't looking so good in terms of being able to justify it as global warming. Whether that's the effects of the volcano in the Southern Hemisphere or whatever, but the data are not coming in the way they're supposed to. So this logic is that we need to migrate to an increasingly virtual world of robotics, minimizing labor, and centralizing authority, power, political structures under a logic that is really quite old, a philosophical framework, that being really, to be blunt, utilitarian Marxism, and the idea of a command economy, the idea that a small number of entities globally can effectively control the world through a command economy structure. And they seem to advocate, and this is what's, of course, we've heard, you will own nothing and be happy. And no one ever really explains what's behind that statement. And it's just thrown out as a kind of a buzzword or a, you know, a rallying cry. There's actually a business logic behind it. It's a business model. You will own nothing and be happy. And one of the slangs that's used in the investment community is rent-seeking behavior. This is the logic that resources would be more effectively managed globally in a densely populated world if only everything, all resources were controlled by a small number of people, a small number of companies, and they could be allocated out appropriately for the greatest efficiency in kind of a rent-based model. So this is akin to, and this is no surprise because a lot of the people advocating this stuff have roots in the software industry. And so just like when you get your Adobe package products, if you use Adobe products for your video editing or whatever, or you get your Microsoft products, you no longer buy those applications, you rent them. And so if you understand how, you know, most of us have had to get Microsoft Word or whatever, and we're familiar with that kind of rent-based model. That's the vision for the entire world, that all resources should be managed in that way. So to touch on a topic, you wouldn't own your Tesla. You would rent your Tesla or lease your Tesla. Or, you know, for instance, if you're a Porsche aficionado right now, you can do a deal with Porsche to allow you pay a premium, but you can go pick up whatever Porsche you want and drive it for a while and then turn it back in and get another one. That's the kind of business model that is behind this statement. You will own nothing and be happy. But it's grounded in a belief system that we need to have a smaller population. We cannot overcome the obstacles that we face globally in terms of resources. This is Malthusianism, right? That the idea that there's limited resources and people, we cannot innovate our way out of our box. We have no other pathway other than to reduce the global population. And this, of course, feeds into that other main meme that is so intimidating and frightening, which is global population reduction, which we hear so much about. And there's all this jibber jabber that the vaccines are intended as a depopulation weapon. I'm not there, despite my having been blackpilled in so many other ways. But
what is your thoughts on the intention of the vaccine?
So I've spoken about that lately in a couple of lectures. One I gave in Florida about a week and a half ago, and another one I gave in Richmond, Virginia. And I have those on my Substack, so folks can listen to the long version. And of course, this plays into the meme that I'm controlled opposition and I'm just making excuses for the global predators and the CIA, et cetera. So I'm just acknowledging that some of my detractors will say that. Be that as it may, I can't say what's going on in Tony Fauci's head, just to use one example, or Klaus Schwab's. God knows, I have no idea what goes on in his head. I think it's whatever Henry Kissinger puts into his head. I think that's a little bit of an empty bag that gets filled periodically. But I don't know what goes on in people's heads. I can't. I'm not a mind reader. I, in the book that we're just about to publish, it's in the very last copy editing, we kind of walk through a lot of different hypotheses. And I really think that what we're dealing with is a multifactorial condition in which we have some, we absolutely have some nefarious actors that have exploited what has occurred here. And this includes various players involved in the global financial system. There's a thesis that they are the ones behind this and triggered all this. This is Ernst Wolf in particular likes to forward this. And I'm not in any way casting shade on Ernst Wolf. I think his work has been bloody brilliant. I've learned so much from what he's put out that's been translated into English from the native German. But I'm increasingly convinced the data are coming in, the information is coming in, that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was undercapitalized, running on fumes, under pressure. This is no excuse. Didn't have adequate safety protocols and was messing about with things they should never have been messing about with. And that's the gain of function research and absolutely EcoHealth Alliance and those characters were busy involved in technology transfer. And there's no question that Defense Threat Reduction Agency, I've heard this directly first person, U.S. DITRA has been and continues to be funding the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We have the documentation that NIAID has that'll come out in hearings if the election flips. But it looks like that's the smoking gun. This is an engineered pathogen. I wouldn't call it a bioweapon, but it could well be. There's the Chinese Communist Party history of development of bioweapons goes back to when they assimilated part of the Japanese bioweapon program that was so successful in World War II. Of course, the other major part of that Japanese program got imported lock, stock, and barrel to Frederick, Maryland, and other nefarious places in the U.S. as USAMRID, and as kind of the launching point for the U.S. biowarfare capabilities. So I'm not in any way saying that the Chinese are the only bad actors here, but their weapons program, bioweapons program, absolutely does have roots in the nefarious Japanese biowarfare program. And by the way, Bobby Kennedy's new book delves into this deeply, where he looks at the origin of the virus and the Wuhan lab and the cover-up. So it seems to have leaked out sometime fallish 2019, maybe a little earlier than September, probably through some breach of containment protocol. I'm not convinced that that the CCP intentionally released this into the beating heart of their industrial sector. That just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I am increasingly compelled that once it was out, the CCP exploited that, and they actively pumped propaganda into the White House through a variety of channels that are now increasingly being revealed. I'm increasingly of the belief that my former colleague Michael Callahan, CIA agent, MD from Harvard, that was in the area early in 2020, if not late 2019, was subjected to Chinese propaganda. They knew who he was. They knew what his background was. And I can't imagine that the information that he encountered was not carefully crafted, even though he wasn't aware that that and didn't believe that to be the case. He brought back to the United States a sense of crisis and, alarmism that played a key role in advancing a lot of the mistakes that happened here. And then we also have Mr. Michael Pottinger, who had deep roots in China and appears to have also had intelligence roots through his time with Michael Flynn. He's a China hand. So I think there's, the evidence is coming out that the dying on the street and the rapid manufacturing of the hospital complex and all that stuff was propaganda, still being sorted out who pushed it. Was it actually the CCP or was it enemies of the CCP? That's still pretty cloudy. So there's that agenda. The CCP seems to have played a role, whether it was intentional or reactionary, exploitative, in fostering a group of policies that caused the West to destroy their own economies. It was a masterwork. If that is what they did, it is one of the great successes in many people point to Sun Tzu, the application of Sun Tzu's logic in asymmetrical warfare. And there's no question that the policies, which are very much the China model, were deployed in throughout the West and caused enormous harm. But then there's also such clear evidence that the central banks of the world, including the Federal Reserve, which, you know, many people don't appreciate, are privately owned. They are not national. They were facing a monetary crisis akin to 07, 08 in 2019. And they had a liquidity issue. And the events that transpired allowed them to inject massive amounts of capital. And we never hear the words anymore. You remember, it was just a few months ago, the cool hip thing was modern monetary theory, MMT. You can rack up as much debt as you want. It's not going to have any impact. And then suddenly the bills come due. And Rishi, I guess, is now the bag holder there in the UK. We'll see how that goes for him. But I'm afraid that it's your colleagues and yourself that are going to really pay the price, and the German people, and Europe in general, for these policies. And then we have King George III, who was the original person that announced the Great Reset. Another important fact to know, it was not Klaus Schwab. Klaus Schwab was actually playing second fiddle to what is now King George in initiating that. So the Great Reset agenda, which has a strong financial component, seems to also have been brought to bear into this largely manufactured crisis, it now appears, involving a gross overestimate of the risk of the virus. And we can again thank the United Kingdom's researchers for a lot of that gross overstatement of risk. I think it's Imperial College gets the gold star for that little bit of propaganda. You know, now we're on the threshold of the Bank of International Settlements has test fired central bank digital currency, which they want to couple with digital IDs for everyone. That was everyone's concern, that the vaccine passports were just a kind of a sneaky point of entry to a digital ID. I don't have any direct data. It's just circumstantial, but it's very convenient. Who's benefiting from this? What's behind it? What are the agendas? I'm in the a whole lot of people made a whole lot of money on this and advanced their political and other power-based objectives, not the least of which is our good friend, Mr. Gates, who every time I turn around, as I've run down these various rabbit holes trying to understand things, like what's happened to journalism and advocacy journalism, there I find the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation looking at me through the glass. And Mr. Gates seems quite proud of his prescient investments in vaccines, et cetera, which curiously seem to have benefited from access to information through various planning sessions that he's helped capitalize together with the World Economic Forum, such as Event 201. Which I think his capitalization of these planning scenarios is absolutely not benign. I think at a minimum, it has the appearance that he is.
For years, people have been asking me where I buy my watches. Many of you may know I'm a watch collector, I'm a watch investor, and those as an asset class have done me very well in the last 15 years. I have never shared where I source my watches from or my watch dealer until now. My watch dealer used to be a professional footballer for Manchester United, and he formed a watch brand called Broadwalk. And he sources the higher-end brands like Rolex, Audemars Piguet, Patek Philippe and Richard Mille. I trust him, I've used him for many years, and recently we've done a partnership. Hence, I'm inviting you, if you want to start investing in watches and protect your money from the banks and inflation, to check out Broadwalk. That's BROADWALK. And the website is broadwalkgroup.com. The email is sales@broadwalkgroup.com. And please don't share this, but his number is 07496 878 153. Obviously, only message him if you're serious about buying and investing in the higher end watches. People have been asking me for years, and for the first time ever, you can get access to my watch team.
Is using his capital in his status and the guise of his nonprofit philanthropy to develop intelligence that he then employs in his other business activities.
What are those other business activities?
What other business activities? He has a variety of funds that invest in vaccines and green energy and farming and meat alternatives, and it just kind of goes on and on and on. But it seems to circle largely around, he clearly, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has made investments relating to birth control and the interface of vaccines and birth control in India and Africa. I'm not sure what Mr. Gates's vision is, but it seems to always result in some form of a monopoly or other and considerable profit and a reshaping of the world in ways that a lot of us would really rather not see. And you asked the question, I still haven't answered. What's the alternative? What's the way forward? I think personally, I'm increasingly a fan of decentralization. I think we've had enough experimentation with command economies, and that never seems to turn out very well. And the logic now seems to be that, well, the problem with utilitarianism and command economies has been that we just didn't have enough data and enough tools to process all that data. And now we've got these cool new things like machine learning and deep learning, artificial intelligence, et cetera, that now if we just had enough data from everybody in the world, we could run that into our massive, metaphorical spreadsheet and really figure out how to make the world hum on rails. And I'm not there. What we've seen over the last 3 years has just been a chronic bungling. The management of this affair has demonstrated a profound level of incompetence. And what blows my mind is that the World Health Organization, the CDC, and a lot of these other actors that have been involved in this seem to think that this provides CEPI as another example, seems to think that the record of the last 3 years justifies that they should get more money and more power. That doesn't work in my deep learning algorithms, but maybe it does in theirs. I think that I believe that we should stop defining humanity using the language of economics. I think we should stop defining human beings as economic entities, as numbers on a spreadsheet. I think we are so much more than that. And I think we need to, have you noticed the death of the arts? Who cares about the arts anymore? It's all about how rich are you? How much money can you make? Your jet, your boat, how fancy your car is, what you got in the bank, how much power you have. What happened to the arts? What happened to community? What happened to spiritualism? What happened to commitment to our children, to commitment to education, commitment to future generations? you know, all this talk about green living and the green world, but I don't see much evidence of that. I see a whole lot of talk and exploitation of things like nitrogen loads in Dutch farmers as ways to justify other agendas. And I personally, I think that the folks that have been advancing these agendas have been doing so for so long, and they've amassed such massive amounts of capital that they are going to have their way with us to some extent. And the question is, what can we do about it? And I think it's kind of time to hole up. And, you know, suddenly the preppers don't look so crazy. I think that building skills for self-sufficiency and absolutely committing to community and working through what does that mean? What I've seen, because I've been traveling a fair amount, including internationally, is the rise of communities, special interest communities, resistance communities, that are existing within the structure of the established political economic umbrella. And, you know, when I in Ireland, in the UK, in Italy, in France, and now to some extent in Austria, and then, of course, in Africa, they kind of don't care about the Westerners anyway. They live their own lives and they're busy doing deals with the Silk Road business with China, bless their hearts. So I think that for those of us that value freedom, and Matthias Desmet teaches that's probably only about 10% of the population. The rest want to be told what to do, unfortunately. For those that care about personal freedom, liberty, sovereignty, it's kind of time to think global but act local.
When you Google your name, Robert, Google doesn't... I could just pause there.
Please don't use Google. There's so many better search engines. I am toxic. I'm toxic on Facebook. My name alone.
Right. So why are you toxic on Google and Facebook?
Well, I would refer you to Silicon Valley to answer that question. Google seems to have really gotten bent out of shape. When I said these four words on Joe Rogan, you'll recall December 31st. Of last year, mass formation psychosis, or I guess it's three words, mass formation psychosis. So what that triggered was folks looking into what has been done to so many of us in terms of information manipulation and thought control. And the role of both corporate media and tech in facilitating that, in collusion with larger corporations as well as the governments, Western governments, the Five Eyes Alliance. I think it's been... I think a case can be made let me just say, there was a paper just out yesterday published in the journal called Minerva, in which some Israeli and American social scientists, et cetera, did a series of surveys of physicians and medical scientists that have been subjected to the same processes that I have, in some cases even more severely, in some cases less. And they've all had similar experiences, and it has followed a pattern that's well established for quenching dissent. It's a pattern that is of affirmation, censorship, et cetera, that they document quite well, that has been documented in prior academic publications over many years and seems to have been deployed systematically here. And so I guess it might be that in part, because I was out front on a lot of things, I got hit earliest and hardest. So that's one. I'm not whining or complaining. I'm not saying that it's not fair. None of this is fair. But certainly the aggressive editing of my Wikipedia page by a pseudonym sock puppet that seems to be closely affiliated with British intelligence and has remarkable 24-hour productivity and has edited the Wikipedia pages of many in the medical freedom movement and anybody that speaks in favor of things like hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin or early treatment or alternatives, et cetera, all seem to have had the benefit of the same heavy hand in either writing them out of history, destroying their reputations or whatever in Wikipedia. So there seems to be a strong intelligence community component to this. In coordination with these large corporate entities, in cooperation with entities in the U.S. government. But what's been fascinating to me as I travel is that what I've observed in the United States is happening in parallel to colleagues in all over the world, Latin America, Italy, the UK, France. Dieter Raul has had his career destroyed. I met him in Marseille in his office. Interesting gentleman, but whatever his faults are, he didn't deserve what was done. I think that those that are out front often take the hits in the more obvious way. I mean, my wife wrote this book, How to Prepare for the Novel Coronavirus, between the phone call we got from Callahan on January 4th of 2020 and published it in the first week in February, well-referenced. You know, she's a PhD in biotechnology and public policy. I'm an MD and an MS in whatever I do, nucleic acids and vaccines and that kind of stuff. And so it was a well-written, you know, 100-plus page written for our neighbors, you know, here in central Virginia, rural Virginia, you know, just average people. What can you do? Talked about things like using alcohol wipes on airplanes, stuff that's become commonplace. And it was censored by Amazon, taken down in March with no appeal, no explanation other than it violated the community standards, something that was unprecedented at the time. This is March of 2020. So we've kind of been out front all the way through and taken the hits as a consequence, just trying to help people, which has been one of the things that has been particularly troublesome is to be doing your best, sacrificing everything, working your can off, trying to save people's lives and help them understand, and then have these coordinated attacks come at you. And from both sides. I mean, from the far right, I get attacked as controlled opposition now lately, although that seems to have died down. With all kinds of scurrilous claims that two different versions of why I'm a mass murderer have been floated. So that's no fun. But the accommodation I have to make is none of this is fair. None of this is right. None of this is proper. It is complete, asymmetric, unrestricted information warfare. And early on, I figured out that this was the case, which is why I started podcasting. I just said, okay, the media is going to do what the media does. And if I just speak my truth and speak from the heart and accept podcasts, talk to whoever wants to talk to me. And at first, I burned through podcasts that were a little unusual. Each podcast kind of represents a different community. And there's a lot of different communities in the world with a lot of different points of view. And I've had opportunities to interact with many of them over the last 3 years, which I guess is a great thing. How wonderful to have that opportunity.
Robert, it's interesting here at this point when you say you're in favor of a more decentralized world at the top level, but podcasting in a way is a decentralization of media, which maybe can break up the media control. Would you agree with that?
It is central to what I'm doing. I'm sitting in my new studio with a 3-camera rig. I don't have the camera set up yet. And obviously, I still have to adjust the lighting a little bit more because I'm blown out. Earlier, it was good, but now it's a little excessive. I do think that alternative media is revolutionary. This is about information. It is about information control. People, you know, I've had folks like my friend Stephen Bannon likes to reprimand me and tell me to stay in my lane, quote unquote. I hope I'm not telling stories. I was just on with him earlier today. I think the world of him. I've learned so much from him about media war and so many other things. But what people don't understand is, I did what I did when I was 28 years old, but I've done a lot since then. And I've done a lot of work writing proposals and contracts. I'm quite good at it. And this includes proposals to the federal government for companies that have been very involved at the forefront of social media, including companies that do things that, that I was talking, you know, I've been granted classification with DOD and I have seen things and know of things that go on. There's, for instance, it came out the other day, one investigative group was speculating that Twitter was actually battle tested during Arab Spring. That is a true statement, absolutely. And that may have something to do with why the Gulf money helped capitalize in a significant way Elon Musk's purchase, I speculate. I'm quite familiar with many aspects of the capabilities of modern social media. And as I said in that essay, Twitter is a weapon. It's not a business. People are very naive about their use of social media. But alt media like this, what we're doing right now, I saw, was it Poynter Institute? So one of these organizations that does forecasting for corporate media. I put out a report at the end of last year that I found fascinating. And they bemoan the fact that mainstream corporate media is dying. And I think a case can be made that the Trusted News Initiative managed by the BBC is really kind of also a trade organization that is structured to try to hold the bulwarks for corporate media and to resist the advance of alternative media and the disruption of alternative media. I think that it is it's another one of these cases where they cover their true purpose and intention with words about freedom and democracy and apple pie and motherhood. But in fact, they're just another trade organization trying to support their customers. And in this big analysis of what's going on in media that came out at the end of last year, they specifically flagged the podcast, and in particular, they emphasized, I guess this must have come out about February, they emphasized Joe Rogan and mentioned that Joe Rogan had various nefarious actors on, such as myself, but that they still had to acknowledge his profound disrupting effect that was really represented a major threat to their market space. I mean, 11 million, and Joe didn't just get, it's didn't like he flew through a switch and had 11 million followers. You know, he built this darn thing over years and years and years of just being honest and straightforward in himself and being genuine with people. And now he, you know, with every podcast, he blows the likes of CNN right out of the water. I mean, just to put a pin on it, in my own modest way with our Substack, we now reach routinely, day after day after day, between 400,000 and 750,000 people opening. That's not just delivered. We have a subscriber base of about 220,000 now, of which only a small fraction are paying because we give it out for free because it's about the information. And people, for some reason, voluntarily are willing to pay a subscription price, in part because otherwise they can't get in the chat underneath, and which keeps the trolls out. So there's an upside to that. But these are numbers, even in my little world, where I'm equaling or surpassing primetime broadcast at CNN. That's just, you know, a physician scientist broadcasting from a horse farm in Virginia without, you know, I don't have any, Spotify didn't drop $11 million on my head. Dear Spotify, give me a call. it's a brave new world, isn't it, huh? And the truth. So let me say, this young man, Cameron Wallace, who's the producer for Steve Bannon, and trust me, you don't want that job. Cameron, in one of our first broadcasts together, where I was actually in Steve's studio in his home, which, by the way, looks like a scene out of Animal House most of the time. And a big step up was when they got a maid to clean the toilet. I was hanging out with Cameron in the kitchen having a coffee before we were going to do the hit. And he talked about pirate radio. It just hit me, you know, bang in the head like a brick. That's kind of what we're doing. It's the early days of rock and roll. It's not going to last. They're going to find some way to control us. But in the meantime, we're having a good time, aren't we?
Well, I call this show Disruptors, Robert, because I think that mainstream media needs disrupting. I do agree with you that I think some things have become a bit too centralized and global, and they need breaking up to have a more fair free market, if you like, less monopoly, more competition.
Yep.
I'd like to move the conversation on a bit, if you don't mind. There's a couple of things I want to come back to. AI, central digital currency, population control, they were referenced, but I wanted to let you speak. I'd like to come back to those. But before I do, I'd like to ask you a question. In your professional opinion, is depression real? And is medication the right course of action to cure depression if it's real?
Depression is absolutely real. It's multifactorial. It can be organic. People experience depression after traumatic brain injury. They experience depression from a lot of different causes, and some of those can just be innately organic. Is depression a biochemical sickness? That's where the pharmaceutical industry wants us to go. I think that that's very self-serving. I think the people that advance that thesis of mental health in general as a biochemical imbalance, as a master kind of global model for mental illness, often have a vested interest in promoting that model. I think that depression is too broad of a category to speak about it in a global sense. Is it a thing? I think it's, I'm always torn. Am I a splitter or a lumper? In the case of depression, I think I'm a splitter. I think it's, there's a lot of things going on there. Sorrow and grief is, which can be interpreted as depression, are normal human psychological responses to certain types of stress. And to those that don't experience those things are typically psychopaths. It is a fundamental part of human bonding to experience loss and grief. And those that don't, I think, are dangerous in various ways because they are able to not have empathy. They're disconnected from the rest of their human and animal. They're disconnected from the world. So is chemical modification. I don't want to go all the way to say that we should not provide, there should not be any pharmaceutical interventions available or other bioelectrical modifications. But many people experience relief from depression without having to resort to chemicals. I suspect, I don't know the data, I haven't seen the randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, but a little bit of love goes a long way. And the same is true with empathy in combating depression in our world. Have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you. There seems to be some moral conflicts with maybe big corporations that might have the profit motive more than the human motive. The quandary of the pharmaceutical industry where you couldn't say for sure that there should be no medication support, but there's a self-serving interest, without blowing any whistles or pointing any figures, there is clearly a self-serving interest if...
Well, let's call a spade a spade. The pharmaceutical industry has shown a widespread disregard for ethics, for willingness to live within the guardrails of government laws. They constantly seek ways to manipulate. It is a fundamental aspect of the pharmaceutical industry culture. It is one of the most aggressive industrial sectors on the planet, and it preys on humans. It preys on it. It is intrinsically built on a thesis of treating human disease, and it requires human disease to be treated in order to make profit. And having been in it, in the belly of the beast, there is the logic. For instance, just one example, as one proceeds with clinical and non-clinical research for a pharmaceutical product seeking licensure, anybody in the industry worth their salt knows that the axiom is you never do a study unless the regulatory agency forces you to do so, because you might discover something that would create some obstacle to getting licensure and making profit. It is the pharmaceutical industry is predatory. Has been for a very long time, and a case can be made that it's been the case since Rockefeller came in seeking some way to further monetize oil products in chemistry, organic chemistry, and basically destroyed the medical system and medical education system that it existed in the West, certainly in the United States, and supplanted it with another one that was based on the use of organic chemical-based pharmaceuticals. And this is an industry that knows no moral bounds. It's not that everybody is like that, but those that rise are typically very, very focused on return on investment for their major stockholders. And that profit incentive seems to supersede anything else. And you know, they can talk until the cows come home about ESG scores, but the proof of the pudding is in the eating. It's in their behaviors. It's in their fines. It's in their avoidance of accountability on the adverse events of marketed products. And the whole world has seen this. If they weren't aware of it before, we've now lived through 3 years of a demonstration of that. Over.
When you say we've lived for 3 years in a demonstration of that, do you mean the COVID vaccines?
Correct. And not just the vaccines, but the obfuscation, obstruction of use of off-patent medicines to treat patients. Physicians all over the world have demonstrated that early treatment saves lives, and yet it has been denigrated and obstructed in a systematic way all the way through this. And I've, we even had Merck ridiculing the safety of ivermectin. Come on, guys. The database on ivermectin is massive, and it is incredibly safe. You can argue about whether or not it's effective, and my personal experience directly, as well as my observed experience and that of many of my colleagues, has been that it is effective in a variety of things, including in early treatment for COVID-19. But you can't say that it's not safe. The data are just overwhelming. And hydroxychloroquine is really quite safe. You know, this is the, what do they call it, Friday-Friday or Sunday-Sunday or something all the way through Africa. Everybody takes it once a week, has been for years. It's incredibly safe. It's safe for use in pregnancy. It's one of the only drugs in that category that's safe for use in pregnancy. The evidence of pharmaceutical industry manipulation of this entire response landscape is overwhelming.
Let's do a quick fire round, Robert. There's so many more questions I want to ask, but you've probably got something to do this week and we could be here for a week. So maybe you could answer these in 15 to 30 seconds.
I'll try. It's not my usual style.
Well, then it might be fun for you. people tend to enjoy the quick fire rounds. This is, I think you'll be up near.
Shit away.
All right then. Great. Is Bill Gates a net positive for humanity?
No.
Why not?
He's a monopolist. I also am at minimum, he's a narcissist. Is he a sociopath or a psychopath? I don't know. That's a matter of genes.
Is a centralized digital currency good for humanity?
No.
Why not?
ESG scores and direct control, it reduces the friction in retaliation, as we saw with Justin Trudeau and his finance minister.
Is there an economic depression coming? And if so, how long and how hard do you think it will be?
I hear from multiple sources and have since summer that the European Union is truly heading into a dark winter. That's a famous statement. I'm not an economist, but I do my best to listen to them. And what I hear is we've got a major correction followed by a series of financial boundary events. For instance, the exhaustion of the Social Security Fund in the United States. And this logic of modern monetary theory that has led many European states and states all over the world, including the United States, to inflate their debt indebtedness is going to result in a major correction. This is part of the logic for why to advance central bank digital currency is there truly has to be some sort of a great reset, because the debt levels are unsustainable. And we seem to have, I hate to quote Karl Marx or reference Karl Marx, but a case can be made that we are moving towards that end point of traditional capitalism that he had anticipated, where the contradictions of capitalism catch up with it. And, you know, there's going to be, we have to move through some series of major economic boundary events. And many people think that one of them happens pretty much now.
Does the population need controlling?
That, I think, so China, I think we can learn from China in this. China absolutely tried to impose population control and depopulation agenda through controlling family size. And that caused all kinds of problems. And they are reverberating through time. And they apparently are looking at a abrupt decline in population coming up in the next couple of decades, or maybe a little beyond. But they've got another boundary event in terms of population. Point being, that I think the population, my sense is that the planners always have a repeated need to think they have to intervene, and that they are smarter than biology and human behavior, and they have to intervene, otherwise everything's going to go to hell. Because we can't control ourselves. And I tend to fall on the side of, humans, we may be a little slow, but we eventually figured out and that the population crisis that's envisioned might well have not even come to this point if we hadn't had the kind of do-gooder intervention logic that developed during the 60s and 70s of feed the world, et cetera, and that resulted in unsustainable population growth in areas that didn't have adequate food supply natively. And that, you know, there's a saying that physicians talk about is that tincture in time will cure many things. Tincture of time. And I think that with population, a little less intervention and a little more patient watching is what this doctor orders.
What's the biggest cover-up in your profession?
Whew, okay. I can't even answer that. That the what's, you know, what has been revealed. I just know my little sector. I don't know about cardiology. I don't know about neuropsychiatry. I mean, what we have learned over the last few decades is that there has been just huge cover-ups of major scandals. I think that maybe what we're in the middle of certainly is world class and maybe unprecedented. The ability to deploy information control, propaganda, censorship, and deploy a false narrative of safe and effective globally in the heavy-handed way that it's been done is certainly got to be one of the greats and is profoundly humbling in terms of acknowledging the power of available to the modern totalitarian state.
If man and machine come together, where does that end?
We have seen so many dystopian science fiction versions of that. I feel like it's redundant to even go there. I mentioned some of those at the start with Cyberpunk and Bruce Sterling and Shapers and Mechs and RoboCop and Terminator and the Wachowskis' dark vision of the Matrix, which seems to now have been so intensely prescient that red pill and blue pill is lingua franca worldwide now, I think. I do not think this goes well. Mr. Musk is currently being portrayed as a great hero of free speech, but Mr. Musk is also the largest defense contractor in the United States, has Starlink and Neuralink coming up, and Twitter is a weapon. I think that I fear for the future that our children will inherit. I truly, sincerely do. And I just want to give a shout out to the great UK artist, commentator, Bob Moran, who somehow manages to capture a brilliant insight with his little strip on a daily or weekly basis. He just seems to have a way of penetrating into the underlying truth of things. But I do think that the idea of, I don't know who's pestering me now, the idea that that we have sufficient knowledge of biology proceed with blithely in modifying human evolution genetically and mechanically is the most profound hubris I can imagine. And why? Why do it? You know, we're incredible organisms. We're almost limitless. We have not even begun to explore the wonder of our minds of our collective minds. Why do we have to move into this bizarre vision of biomechanical and neuromechanical and neurophysiologic, you know, this is like a Silicon Valley oligarch's wet dream, but I don't see it.
Is Elon Musk a net benefit to society?
I think the jury's out on that one. And of course, I need to acknowledge my conflict of interest. I would like to be let back on Twitter. Thank you very much. It would help me build my Substack. If it's a different Twitter than has existed in the past, I think the place has become a sewer, surpassed only by Telegram. And I don't go on TikTok, so that might be even worse. I don't know. I think. I'm going to withhold judgment. I'm kind of on the fence on that one. I think that he is a wefer, by the way, as are most of the Bitcoin people. You know, they talk the talk of being revolutionaries, but in the end, most of them seem to have been co-opted is my sense. And this whole thing has brought me into that world. I've had the chance to hang out with the whales, which I'd never imagined that would be part of my life. But they're not all that way, but a lot of the thought leaders are very much aligned with World Economic Forum and with the possibility that they might make oodles of money in converting their cyber decentralized digital currency into BIS, a central bank digital currency. So I just don't know. Elon and what's the other one that his buddy from PayPal days that runs Palantir. I'm not entirely sure about him either. I think that folks, when they get that wealthy, they live in a different mind space than the likes of you and me. And they seem to become disconnected with a lot of the things that we take for granted as fundamental, let's say, here's a word, Judeo-Christian ethics.
Are you talking about Peter Thiel?
Yeah, I am. Sorry, it slipped my mind.
Right. So the last four, let's do this in 10 seconds if you can. What do you know that most people don't?
Oh, not much. There aren't very many people that can plaster an old hog barn and turn it into a recording studio. Let's see. I think one of my core competencies has been kind of understanding in the past how the government really works, and being able to navigate it and help make things happen. Mary Holland, when I first met her, who's the chief executive officer of Children's Health Defense, and spent time as a young person in education in the Soviet Union, When she met me and talked about what I do with the government is, or used to do for my consulting business, she said, there used to be people like that in the Soviet Union. As the Soviet Union was kind of coming unglued and the bureaucracy became so unwieldy, there were people like you who were basically fixers, who knew the system well enough that they could work in between the cracks and enable things to get done that otherwise can't get done because just the burden of the bureaucracy and its inefficiencies. So I think I'm knowledgeable about that in ways that there aren't many people. There aren't too many people that understand this spectrum of the discovery science world in biotechnology all the way through licensure. Because there's a group of separate cultures. There aren't many that have kind of my bona fides in discovery research and then also have been able to operate successfully in advanced development, which is the first one is the Wild West, cowboy, shoot 'em up, Yahoo. Let's see what works. As you can see with Ralph Baric and the Wuhan Institute of Virology is just one example. Then there's the, well, how do you take it through this highly structured regulatory process, take it through to licensure. I'm one of those few that kind of gets all of that and gets the government and gets small business startups and raising capital. I've done biotech startups. I've spent too much time talking to Sand Hill Road investors, etc. So I think that's another thing that makes me a little different. And I'm not a bad equestrian, but there are many better ones than me. But probably not too many people that can shoe a horse 1 minute and then talk about, I said shoe, not shoot, and then talk high science.
What's the best advice you ever remember receiving?
When I interviewed as an undergraduate with Bob Cardiff for a position in his laboratory, which is a breast cancer mouse mammary tumor virus laboratory, I was trying so hard to be humble. And he looked me straight in the face and said, ice cold, he said, I have no time for false modesty. And that was kind of a you're no longer in Kansas anymore moment. And he still accepted me into his laboratory. But it's hard to remember sometimes for those of us that don't want to be seen as egotistical, it is right and proper, and you do need to own your own core competence, and not try to hide it. There's this biblical saying, don't hide your light under a bushel basket. I think it's the same thing.
What's the worst advice you ever remember receiving?
Get an MD. I mean, neither of my kids have any interest in that. They're both computer scientists. I can't recommend any young people to go into modern medicine. I'm sorry to say that, but it's really, really dysfunctional. The juice is not worth the squeeze.
This show is called Disruptors. What does the word disruptive mean to you, Robert?
So I'm biased because of all of the logic and language around investors and disruptive technology. I'm profoundly influenced by this book of Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is the one that gave us these words like paradigm shift, these phrases. disruption is an absolute necessity in enabling. One of my models of the world is that there are a lot of forces that resist disruption, and a lot of, we could call them conservative forces, not in the political sense. There are a lot of forces that want things to stay the same, even though systems are not particularly functional in solving problems. And as a consequence, what happens is you build up a larger and larger and larger gap between the unmet need, the opportunity, or however you want to phrase it, and the existing solution space. And as if you create obstacles to disruption and to revolution, to abrupt change or whatever, then what happens is the system becomes more and more disassociated between the need or the opportunity and the current solution set. And then something will occur, some event that will cause it to suddenly realign. And we experience that almost like an earthquake or a volcanic explosion or a major disruption in existing processes, economics, whatever. And I think that disruptors are super important to alleviate stress, this stress that comes as systems develop dysfunction or misalignment over time. And so that's, for me, disruption has to do with enabling change and facilitating change in a what can be a very constructive way, but if the forces are resisting that, it can be extremely destructive.
Where can we follow you, Robert, and maybe get some of your research, and where do you want us to join to be able to be in your tribe?
Well, tribe, that's an interesting statement, and an important one. On the topic of tribe, what I've tried to say all the way through the last 3 years is don't take anything that I say as the gospel truth. What I'm trying to do is help people to access information, understand things that are otherwise confusing to them, and help them make their own decisions, interpret the information themselves. I think that is the best way to armor ourselves against these psychological and thought manipulation tactics that have been deployed on us. This is the best armor for all of us in the information war era, is to learn to think for yourself, learn what the logical fallacies are. And by the way, there's a great website called Your Logical Fallacy Is. It's not mine, but I recommend it. In terms of me, the book, The Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Times Ahead, should be coming out soon. It's in absolute last stage editing. Matter of fact, I should be working on that right now. And our Substack, we treat as a business. It's how I sustain myself now. And so we respect our customers, as I always did as a consultant, and very much value them. And we put out product daily. The term is used, content. We're generating a lot of content, I'm told. So that's rwmalonemd.substack.com. And those are the deeper thought pieces. And then the daily chitter chatter, since I'm summarily ejected from Twitter and LinkedIn without appeal and without warning, you can find me on Getter at RW Malone MD, Gab, and Truth Social. The Telegram channels are that purport to be me are not me. So don't blame me for anything that goes on there.
I want to say thank you very much for giving your time today, Robert. It's been fascinating to listen to you and look forward to continuing to hear more about your work.
Thank you, sir. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to you and to your viewership.
Take care, Robert. Thank you.